Well, hello, everybody. This is Randy Wotton, CEO of Maxio and your host for SaaS Expert Voices, where we bring the experts to you to talk about what's going on today in the broad landscape of SaaS and what is on the horizon. With me, I'm very excited to have Alex Diaz-Asper join us, who's had an incredible career. Started off in M&A and then PE for 6 years with DKW Capital. He did another tour with a group called Alfred Street Partners, and during that time, he actually made the switch to CFO for TARP, one of their portfolio companies. And so he has that great background in terms of being on the investor side and then being an operator. And after that, in 2008, right when the Lehman Brothers disaster blew up, he decided that'd be a great time to start his own advisory services firm, now called Tarsus. Well, welcome, Alex, and what an interesting career.
Thank you. Thank you, Randy. Great to be here.
So one of the things we were talking about in the pre-brief was just maybe because you've had these three chapters of your career, the M&A and PE, and then as an operator, and then now as really the last 15 years as an advisor, maybe talk a little bit about some of the lessons learned, starting back with PE and M&A in terms of helping CEOs better run their business, using financial operations to better inform their go-to-market strategies. What were some of the key lessons learned from that time of your career?
Yeah, you know, the fun part of that is that I've seen it now from both sides as the investor. Now I'm the actual guy providing the information to the investors. So, you know, it's very, very, very interesting to see both sides of that thing. Also, plus in my M&A days, I kind of saw the end result, where people were trying to sell their businesses. You know,
right.
It was in the telecom space. We were actually acquiring a lot of companies on the buy side. So we saw the end of those processes. So it's been a very unique and kind of fun experience to see all sides of those different things. So it's very helpful. And, you know, throughout all those different elements, finance, accounting, good numbers, clean books, you know, it's kind of a cliche, super important. There's nothing but help you in all these processes.
And in fact, I mean, one of the things I quote often, it came from a law firm actually based in Atlanta, but they're a national firm, and they say the number one deal killer is an accounting error. And that, especially in SaaS, where you're doing revenue recognition, it's not according to GAAP. And so people can come up with all these creative ways of doing rev rec. But then when the MRR roll forward doesn't make sense or the customer cohort analysis doesn't make sense, that's when PE firms, especially, and they got a bunch of Excel jockeys jump in and start digging in and they find more issues and they either trade down or they don't do deals because the numbers don't work.
I've seen deals blow up because of exactly that reason, you know, and I've been on both sides of that. One side, you're panicking. You found the error. Like there's a little issue in your spreadsheet. I don't know who found it, but somebody's starting to look at it and is like, uh-oh, now what? And to the other side where you're like, hey, look, we are buying a company because we want kind of revenue stream. Yeah. We're valuing the business. If I'm an investor, I'm valued it on an AR multiple. And all of a sudden, the AR is not what I thought it was going to be. I have to retrade. And then that's kind of a difficult situation. Those deals have a high probability of breaking up and blowing up.
I'll tell you, just not having done as many as you have, but having sold a couple of companies and then being corp strategy at Seismic after I sold Percolate to Seismic and did a couple of, we did several M&A motions, ended up buying two companies and then also doing a strategic investment. But to your point is as the buyer or the investor, you're primarily investing in that asset, especially if it's a bigger company, right? The revenue, the customer revenue, clearly the IP and the people, you want those folks, but you're really counting on that revenue to get that multiples, either at the top line revenue growth or at the EBITDA level. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't pass the sniff test, it makes it super hard to get the deal done. I think that's a great point. And I would say that we also find that our best customers are usually those that have been multiple times CEOs or multiple times CFOs because they know how important it is to have the back office in ship shape and seaman-like as much as it is to have the go-to-market engine going. So that's a great lesson learned. And then you decided to leave the PE, the world of PE, and drop into one of the portcos, TARP, which is not unusual, but I would say often comes with its own challenges because many times the CFO for operating companies come up as from the big six or the big four. They're accountants and they're controllers. And that's just a different way of looking at the world than coming in as an investor PE guy. So kind of what was that? How did you decide you want to make that transition? And what were some of the lessons learned from that experience?
Yeah. That was, it's a great way of putting it. Yeah. I came from what we, you know, like the finance side of it versus the accounting side. And I think you find CFOs like have those general two kind of starting points. Either they came out through accounting or came out through some part of finance. I came up through finance. So I had to learn the accounting. And it's only gotten more and more painful through the years, including lease accounting, 606, all these fun things. But yeah, you know, I've always relied on really good talent, hiring really good controllers, people who could, you know, help me through that process. And that's also important. I mean, there's the systems and the tools, getting out of the spreadsheet world, using systems, the tools like Maxio, and then, you know, hiring the right people to, you know, help you implement those processes, interpret those contracts.
That's great. And then with TARP in particular, you were talking about how when you jumped in, client concentration can really be something is an issue. And initially, it's great to have a big client because they're paying you money.
Right.
At the same time, they can really dictate your roadmap. So if you're trying to build a horizontal solution and they're like, no, I need you to do more for me, you're in this constant state of tension. Can you talk as much as you feel comfortable about that idea of client concentration? And now as you've been advising people, if you have rules of thumb about how much revenue concentration is appropriate?
Yeah, that's a great question. And this is it went back to the acquisition stuff too as well. Clients, investors, and buyers are all going to be looking at this number too. They don't want to buy client concentration unless they really love that one particular client. But it doesn't show scalability if you have this one big client. Yeah, all those issues kind of all wrap themselves up. Like you said, the roadmap. You know, they suck development resources to solve these particular issues, and they kind of your whole firm sort of ends up wrapping themselves around that contract. And, you know, fortunately, we see a lot of times a lot of our clients have gotten themselves in trouble, had a big, you know, cash cow kind of client. They wrapped themselves around it. Everybody was super happy, you know, over-serviced it, et cetera. Didn't focus on other go-to-market or other trying to find other clients. Then that client leaves or that client finds another product or, you know, whatever, it's a large corporation and they get distracted and they get, you know, how it is with these large corporations, who knows what happens with them. And then all of a sudden you're in really difficult existential crisis, like overnight.
Right. If it's the whale and you're the pilot fish sort of hanging on to the side and the whale decides to turn left and you're like, whoa, wait, hang on. do you have a general sense for a rule of thumb for how much revenue you would want from no more than from one client as you're looking as a healthy business?
Yeah, certainly no more than like 20%.
Yeah.
Yeah. Certainly, I think that's no more than 20%. Yeah.
I've used in my past, and I haven't done it a bunch, but like 10%. And so how do you drive down to have no more than one client being representing 10%? Yeah. I think maybe it depends on what scale you are. So I tend to come in at Series C companies. And so if you're still a seed or Series A company, having a company represent 20% of your revenue may be okay. But I think to your point, being able to tell the story about revenue diversification, multiple go-to-market plays, like how are you going to show that you can scale and have a restful sales model while you keep that honeypot?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, at the end of the day, it's all about validation. So the more people who said yes, right? The more data points you have of people saying, okay, I'm going to give you money for this thing. So
that whole product market fit that they're going to pay you and they're going to pay you again. They get through a full cycle in terms of that they renew. Well, great. So that's you jumped from PE in that finance function. You came in as CFO at TARP for a bit, and then you decided to go off on your own. What was the catalyst for that career pivot? And then maybe some of the lessons learned over the last 15 years, we'll get into a little bit more detail around that. But just you've been doing this for a while now. You've got a super successful practice. Like, what was why do you decide to do that? And it seems like it's been super satisfying.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed it. I really enjoy early stage tech companies, working with, you know, I serve two roles now. I'm the managing partner of the firm, but I also do serve as like CFO for about five to eight clients at a time. And I really enjoy working with early stage tech companies.
I find that sucker for punishment. I mean, what is it that you...
I tell people it's like teaching elementary school. Everybody wants to play in the NBA. Everybody wants to be the president, you know?
Yeah, right.
As opposed to later stage, you know, high school kids, you know, they're going to be, you know, lawyers and doctors. You know, it's that kind of atmosphere where they're really, really, that kind of energy about really trying to take over the world is kind of a fun thing to be around.
Okay.
So, I figured, hey, I had two choices. I could either go be a CFO, find another early stage company and go jump in as the CFO there, or start up a whole different way of doing this, of working across a bunch of clients as a CFO and get more exposure to different businesses. Frankly, a lot less risk.
I was just about to say, was it risk diversification? You're not putting all your eggs in one basket.
Part of it. And two things, too. What part of it is that, and part of it is that at early stage CFO, you end up wearing a lot of hats, a lot of administrative hats. So this allowed us to build sort of a key team of accounting. And we have an offshore team based in Bangalore, India. They do a ton of the core accounting, GAAP, U.S. financial statements. So I don't have to spend my time digging into that part of it. So, you know, we have the ability to really create like an infrastructure to do financials, you know, to close the books on a timely basis on a UGAS GAAP basis, you know, using tools like Maxios to do analytical reporting, GAAP revenue, all those kinds of things. So when I get to see the numbers, I'm actually really acting as a CFO.
That's great.
Not a controller, not an AP person, not payroll.
Right. You get to pick what you want to play, which playground you want to play in. One of the things I talk to folks, and I'm primarily focused on B2B SaaS, is there's usually this phase of when a founder, first-time founder, technology person starts their company, they have their quote-unquote uncle do the books. And it's someone that, you know, is okay with Excel. They do cash accounting and they manage it through their bank account. At some point, they hit an inflection point like, oh gosh, and maybe it's when they take on angels that they do an outsourced firm. And we'll talk about the difference between a CPA, bookkeeper, and a type of firm like yours. And then there's another phase. We find it about 30 employees where they actually bring the CFO in-house and say, okay, now we have enough of complexity, enough customers. I need a full-time CFO and I want to build out the finance function. How do you find that play out? When do you get most of your customers in the B2B SaaS space? Is it, and have they all had their uncle and you're coming in there and as they go to accrual and try to think about GAAP, you're like, oh my God, you're pulling your hair out because you got to get all the accounting sorted out. Is that, and then when do they graduate and what's the impetus or the catalyst for graduating from your services to a full-time CFO?
Yeah. So we usually typically get involved kind of even angel round. Angel, as long as they get some funding, but it's typically seed series A. And it's usually that outside capital all of a sudden needs visibility. Because we're one very different, and we do work with some bootstrap companies. It's very different working for a bootstrap company where the entrepreneur is running it out, you know, looking at their bank account and that's how they manage their financial statements versus like, okay, somebody outside the firm needs to know what's going on. Either it's
and
a bank
trust the numbers. I mean, that's the big issue too, right? And as you move into GAAP and RevRec, you have these investors that are trying to understand the ARR. And if you haven't, if you're making up your own rules around ARR, because it's not a GAAP metric, like that can get all hairy and scary like we were just talking about. Yeah.
And then you start talking about these things with, 606 with uncle, as you said, or it's like some bookkeeper or it's like a CPA firm who does their tax. They just can't handle these things. They don't understand these things. And they frankly don't want to. So it's a great starting point for us. And then we typically work with firms until like the Series C range. And then they at that point is where we see they typically hire a CFO.
And at how, that point, how series, sorry for interrupting, revenue size, what would be a typical Series C that you would see, or number of employees, like what's that inflection point that you usually see?
It's usually like maybe like 80 to 100 employees, 15 to $20 million, that kind of range.
Yep.
And it's hopefully a sector that's coming back now.
It's
been a little tight the last couple of years, but
I think that's right. We've actually seen it even a little bit earlier is like 30 to 40 employees in that 5 to 10 million is where we'll see people bringing CFOs. So that must mean then what you're doing for them is you're this advisory services that you're providing. And maybe you can talk a little bit how that is different than tax and audit and accounting. Yeah. What's the layer that you're providing for them? Because that seems to indicate to me that the CEOs and the boards who've done the Series A, Series B have been excited about what you've been providing, and it's that they're able to extend that with you before they bring on the CFO. So what is that sweet spot that you're offering in a set of services?
Well, so we, you know, we're able to do all the things that those firms need, like track the KPIs, track the financial model, try, you know, forecast, tell people what happened and what will happen. Both on the KPI side, on the cash flow side. So bring a lot of visibility for the board. We're very used to dealing with boards. Our CFOs are kind of all been around the block and very much know this space, especially B2B SaaS. So yeah, we can serve up to that role until the Series C. Now, where it gets hard for us at the Series kind of C level typically is at that point, there's a lot of stakeholders, both internally.
You have multiple investors.
Yes. And that sort of investor relationship. Yeah. Uh-huh. And then the management team becomes a lot bigger too. So there's a lot more kind of stakeholder management that we're really not suited for. And at that point, you know, if we're working with one COO and one CEO and the head sales guy, that's okay. And maybe two or three investors, that's okay. And so when it gets, you know, later stage and there's all these different people, that you really do need somebody full time to manage all those.
That's a great point. We had a CFO at Percolate when I showed up, but we had Sequoia, GGV, Lightspeed, First Round Capital. And I just remember as the end of the month, you have to deal with each of their analysts, and our CFO and our controller was filling out their templates. And when we brought Maxio on, then we had the reports that would come out of the subscription momentum report. It just changed the game. We're like, no, here's all the numbers you need. And it allowed it to leverage and really decrease the amount of time you had to spend in that IR, the investor relationship. That's a great insight. So we were just bumping up to this idea of financial operations and how you think about financial operations. You were talking about how financial operations at the end of the day gives you visibility into what happened, what will happen, and what should happen. Can you talk a little bit about that and the distinction you made in our pre-brief around GAAP revenue versus analytical revenue? I thought was a really interesting and powerful distinction.
Yeah. And this is super important as GAAP gets more and more convoluted, that like people, you know, can able to look at and understand these two different things, because boards, acquirers are looking at these two different numbers. So analytical revenue, GAAP revenue is pretty straightforward. It's what as US GAAP will, you know, tell you what the revenue is for that particular contract under AOC 606. So that's what
it's all about. Rev rec.
Right, exactly.
Right. There's the rev rec right, and you got the revenue, you reported on your P&L. And it shouldn't change.
And there's been enough audits. Everybody's been through it. Yeah. So I don't think there's a lot of controversy left in on all that anymore.
Yeah.
So that's pretty straightforward. But again, it can be really convoluted. Like we have a contract, especially with clients who have implementation periods where you can't start the rev rec until after the implementation period. Then there's zero revenue, and then it gets compressed. So then you get some, and then they renew, and then there's a downgrade, right? So that confuses the heck out of everybody. Nobody likes that, right? So we then track analytical, which is essentially, what are you going to renew this contract at? It's $120,000 per year, but you implemented 6 months, you get $120 divided by six for the last 6 months, but the next year it's going to renew at $120. So let's just capture that. What is the run rate revenue from that contract? $120,000. That becomes our ARR.
That becomes one of the things we talk about when looking at targets is contracted ARR versus live ARR, which that's is what you were alluding to in terms of, hey, you've signed a deal, but if it takes 3 to 4 months before it goes live, you can't actually recognize that revenue. And how does that play throughout your revenue recognition? And then to your point, your ARR, so that you're not taking a contraction in year two, which is what you were pointing to because you had this compression. The other thing I think that it really helps inform is how do you figure out a way for your customers to get live sooner. So you reduce the time between contracted and live, the opportunity to recognize revenue, but also get cash.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, a lot of these clients are still charging annually upfront anyways.
Perfect.
That's why that's why car makes sense. And so we got this analytical ARR car, like, okay, even though it might not implement it in 6 months, it's still part of your car, right? It's still part of your basis. It's still part of your validation, right?
Yeah.
Because that's what we're talking about, right? Like what investors and everybody's looking for is how much do they really get validated? Is it a $10 million company? Is it a $15 million company? Is it $20 million? You know, and so many clients have decided to pay you that much, which is really what those important numbers. And then for obvious reason, everybody wants to gravitate to car, right?
Yeah. So that was one of the things I was going to ask you. And so we talked a little bit about investors and what are they looking at? Are they looking at GAAP revenue? Are they looking at analytical revenue? Are they looking at a subset of the revenue? You've been on both sides. What is the metric that's got to be accurate?
Yeah. Unfortunately, all of them.
You're fair. Okay, fair point. Yes. Right, yeah.
And they all serve different purposes. And they all have to be, and you don't want any of them to go wrong because then you have a different problem. Like if you get your GAAP wrong, you don't want to get an embarrassing audit issue.
Right.
And then later stage company, private equity sponsors, they can't seem to be gravitating to GAAP. Mm-hmm. But you, at that stage, if you're, post $20 million, $25 million company, software company, you should you know, these gaps are less important.
Right.
Early stage seed company can have big gaps between gap and car.
Right.
Because they're selling a lot. They haven't been implemented a lot. So I think early stage, obviously, car gets very important. Later stage, they tend to gravitate, but it's important to keep them all straight.
That's an interesting point. I think what I've noticed, one of the big distinctions between VC and PE backed, and is also we're a little bit bigger than at Maxio than what I was at Percolate, is the focus on EBITDA. And part of that may be the shift in the market as well, and people saying efficient growth versus growth at all costs. But when I was VC backed, it was more around product market fit, replicable sales engine, go, go, grow, go, grow. And PE is a little bit more around, hey, we want you to grow. We still want you to be high growth. How that you define that, but we also want to see you starting to get some operating leverage, and that manifests in EBITDA. And I just never really talked about EBITDA before. but it's become a topic of every conversation. I think the other thing that popped over the last year and a half with the rise in the interest rates is actually, I don't know what you would call that, EBITDA, not it, because you have to think about interest.
Yeah.
And so what's the hurdle that you have to bring every year to just be even pay off the interest of 5% or whatever it is that it is now? And it's crazy difference. And that was not true 2 years ago. Money was free.
Right.
So I think that's been interesting, that kind of conflation of looking at ARR growth and bookings growth and churn, but at the same time ensuring you understand the revenue and when that's going to play out, and how do you cover through the P&L, but then also the cash. And so your 13-week cash forecast, I think that's been another thing. I don't know how it's playing out for the types. Well, maybe that's a question for you. So your early stage seed series A, what are you seeing in terms of their ability to raise capital? And what's the assumption in terms of how many months they should go against the burn before they need to raise again?
Yeah, well, the important point, the biggest point, is that a lot of it's not, the markets are still pretty tight. So people are still sort of in that frame of mind of, hey, we got to extend runway.
Okay.
So
is it 18 months, 24 months, 36 months? Like, when they're raising money, what's the assumption in terms of how much money they've raised and how long will that last?
Yeah, I think everybody's so gun shy now. Nobody wants to do less than 24 months.
Yeah.
If it's an external round. Obviously, there's a lot that's still internal rounds. You know,
right.
You just say, let's fight for another day, 12 months out. A lot of use of leverage. There's, you know, some interesting debt products out there, but they do set up problems down the road, right?
Yeah, sometimes totally.
Now is the problem is that people didn't want to raise capital in early 2022, but now, hey, and it took some debt instead of equity. And now some of that debt is not only interest, it's actually amortizing. You got to pay back the principal. So yeah, there's still a lot of cash flow management. So even, we do talk about a lot of these CAR and ARR metrics, but a lot of it, there is a lot of cash flow issues. Yeah. But, you know, having a tool that can help you forecast your billing is super helpful.
And talking a little bit about that one of the things you find is, in general, B2B companies don't struggle with their costs, because something like 65 to 75% of their cost is people. And then it's AWS. It's not a huge, you're not buying data centers around the world. Like, it's not a huge capital expense, and it's how many times do you buy lunch a month? But what you were suggesting, the big challenge, and I appreciate this, is they struggle with defining and forecasting revenue. Can you talk about why that is, and what are the components that the companies you work with are struggling with most, especially that early stage where they're still trying to, I think, get some PMF?
Yeah. Well, because if you have these large annual upfront invoices, knowing when those next batch of annual invoices are coming is super important. Like, you can't assume cash comes in evenly over the 12 months, right?
Right.
So if you signed everybody in Q4, you had a great Q4, and kind of Q3, you're starting to run out of cash. You know, you got it. You see it on the horizon. Okay, here comes all the renewals, and new cash is coming in. So that's super important from the cash flow models to be able to see those kinds of ebbs and flows of cash flow. And then just, you know, having a tool to help you track the renewals, you know, because a lot of clients, you know, unfortunately lose track about what's coming up to do, and then they're scrambling around to try to renew these clients.
We call that revenue leakage. And I mean, everyone calls it that, but revenue leakage. And there's some people out there that I've seen analysts to say that it can be up to 7 to 9% of your revenue is leaking out of the business because you haven't invoiced correctly, you forgot to invoice, or the customer is contesting it. And you think about that, 7 to 9% of the revenue that you've already done all that hard work to get them on board, get them instantiated, get them up and going. They probably paid their first invoice. But to your point, you're coming around on the renewal. If you don't have a system that helps manage that and do subscription management, you don't know, you're not out in front. And if the invoicing is not accurate, you may be missing dollars because you just didn't invoice correctly. Or you, if it's not accurate, you end up in contentious negotiation with your customers. Do you see that playing out across your customer base?
Yeah. And clients are using every little excuse not to pay you.
Sure.
So, so you submit, you get your invoice wrong. Okay, fine. Yeah. Submit a new one 90 days from that.
Right. You get in the back of the line. Get in the back of the line.
Yeah, seriously. Especially Fortune 500. They're awful. These poor little SaaS companies. Yeah. They're awful. They really are.
I mean, you're living and dying by cash, and they're floating the interest and making money on the float, but they're dragging you out. It is another one of those David versus Goliath type thing. But I think going back to our earlier conversation, having a broad base of customers so that you're not reliant on just one big customer. Yes. Really understanding your monetization strategy, who you're outselling what to, and how are you going to do that over time. And then I think having a very disciplined order to cash process. We're talking a lot about that this week. In fact, is the fragmented order to cash and how that causes problems by not having the connection between the data, the technology, and the process. Is that something when you go into an organization and early stage company and they're like, look, we got this product, we're going out, we're going to build this product, we're going to go sell it, so we're going to invest in a CRM system. How do you convince them to adopt back office technology to better inform front office strategies? So taking all the data that they're getting and then using that, as we were just talking about, to define and forecast revenue.
Yeah, it sometimes could be a challenge. Hopefully, if you got an entrepreneur who understands, who's got some experience, then it's relatively easy because you're demonstrating to them. You're showing them, hey, this is how the financial information could look like. You know, we'll show them like a example financial package, which shows all the KPIs and all the forecasts and everything stuff. And then, hey, this is going to make your life easier. It's going to give you the visibility. It's going to give your investors the visibility. So hopefully that wins the day.
Do you charge in the less? I was just wondering, then I don't need you to tell me your business model, but is it one of these things where you're like, look, I don't want to have to work in Excel. So if you adopt one of these technologies, it makes my life easier. I'm only going to have to charge you 10 hours a month versus 15 hours a month. Do you see that play out at all? There's an efficiency for you and pass that on to your clients?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we will charge them less if they're using tools, the right tools. Otherwise, because like you said, it's just hours. And not unnecessarily hours. We are a professional services firm, so hours are not a bad thing.
Yeah.
Right? But, you know, there's kind of hours you want to spend, and hours what really kills a finance organization, if I've learned anything, is just these kind of breaks, like these things, and then the swirl that comes with trying to fix them. You're in that board meeting and you're like, oh, why did ARR go down? Yeah. What was that $10,000 churn last month? We didn't lose any customers last month. And then it's like,
oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And then it turns into a rabbit hole, right? Especially with early stage investors, when you get young analysts who are there trying to prove their salt, and they're going to take you to math camp, and they're like, oh, well, 3 quarters ago your gross retention was 86.2%, and now you're saying that same quarter is 87.4%. Why was there a change? You're like, that was 3 quarters ago. I mean, that was a millennial. Now I'm just talking about what's happening today. But no, they bring you back, and you know, they start to question your numbers. And I think that's where you have to be able to come in with investor grade financials, so that then you're having conversations about strategy, not about accounting rules and reconciliation.
Exactly. Yeah. And nobody likes that. The CEOs don't like it.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's an education process, back to your point about with these entrepreneurs. But we've been pretty successful. Luckily also B2B SaaS companies, they understand technology.
Right. Oh, there's that. Right. So what's the percentage of your portfolio that's B2B SaaS versus other industries?
So on Tarsus now, we do a lot of different things. We do government contract, and we do staff and everything. But the venture practice, I would say, is about 40% of our business.
Okay.
And that was how we started, was out of the venture space. And of those, I would say about 75% are SaaS companies.
Got
for it. Obvious reasons. Those are it's a very attractive business model.
Right. And it also has that endemic issue with RevRec.
Yes. Yes.
I think that's what causes a lot of people. And so have you seen what percent of the B2B SaaS companies you're working with are using a more traditional subscription term, so annual contract, versus a usage or consumption-based model, a metered type model? And are maybe two different questions. We often find that early stage companies are adopting product-led growth. And so they have the product and the customer can sign up for it, self-instantiate. They don't have a sales team. And that also tends to coincide with a usage-based consumption model. As those companies get bigger and they start to move into large mid-market or enterprise, they'll hire a sales team and that'll lead to sales-led, and that may have more annual contracts. Do you think that definition is consistent with your experience in terms of the earlier stage companies are primarily PLG, and are they using primarily usage-based monetization, or are they also trying to play with subscription terms at that stage?
I think kind of a mix of both. We do see that product-led growth, and investors love that kind of stuff and pushing companies in that direction.
Yeah.
We also work with a lot of cyber companies here. We're in Washington, D.C., and they're just traditional subscription-based businesses.
Yeah. What we found in our Maxu Institute report, ironically, that the PLG cohort was lower growth than the SLG cohort. And part of the reason we think is because monthly contracts, usually monthly payments. And so the usage is happening on a monthly basis. And so you start to see the impact of the economy much sooner than an annual contract. If you've been signing year contracts each of the 12 months, you see them drop off, but it's a different type of drop. The ideal situation is to actually have both, so that you have the subscription term type contract that kind of holds it all together. And then if you're fortunate, the PLG or the usage-based pricing mechanism can have some volatility as the companies grow or someone is using more of the widget, right? They pay more for it. You have this aligned value prop for that. But then that also drives your business. So when I first walked into Maxio, one of the people asked me, because Chargeify had been more PLG and SaaS Objects had been more SLG, and said, Randy, PLG or SLG? And I don't think I fully understood the question. I was like, I don't know. I think it's both. And they're like, you're just
choose
playing.
A side.
You're
choose
just,
a side.
Yeah, you're being a politician. I was like, I don't know. But what I think we found is that really is having both going forward in a hybrid model that's going to it's basically figuring out how do you offer value? How do your customers want to pay? And be able to offer that, and then having systems to track it.
Right.
Good. Well, anything else that you're kind of seeing? We'll get to the speed round in just a minute or so. But in terms of you think about disruptions in the office of the CFO, or because you see broadly across all of these companies and then they start to fleet up to CFOs, are you seeing a different type of CFO stepping into the seat these days than 10 years ago or 15 years ago when you first started the company, especially in the B2B SaaS space? Or do you have advice or suggestions for aspiring CFOs that want to be the first step into that role? How do you see the landscape from having seen so many different companies?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the challenge for CFOs is always staying on top of this technology stuff. Whether it's AI, we had a call today earlier with an AI implementation of a sister company of ours is using, how they're using it for their FP&A function, whether it's that or the latest, tech tools, or even your tools are evolving. If you're on Intacct, what's the latest, greatest thing on that? Maxio, what's the latest, greatest thing on that? And you're staying on top of all those things. So that part of it, that's a little bit harder for these early stage kind of CFOs to stay on top of, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, I think I talk about CFOs, at least the generation that I grew up with, is like, you're going to pry Excel from my cold, dead hands, right? And everything was tied to Excel, and they do their own models. And whenever they come into a company, they throw the old model out because it does, of course it's bonk. And so they're going to start over and rebuild the model. And then they're going to, that's the starting point. The other thing I talk about CFOs is because at the end of the day, they're there to be, and partners like you similarly, to absolutely be certain about the cash. That they have a very tight control on their tech stack, and they want very few people involved in touching things like the general ledger. Like, I don't even think my CFO would let me touch the general ledger. He's like, Randy, what do you want to know? Here you go. Here's a report for you. Whereas all those go-to-market professionals, sales, marketing, success services, they adopt a new technology every week. And like, ah, it's kind of cool. Let's try it. Whiz bang. But I think there is this, because you're responsible for the bank account and the cash, the CFO and also the personality is a little bit more risk adverse, that they know what they know and they want to do it that way.
Right, right. Yeah. And I think, I mean, the other, I mean, now that you mentioned that, the other thing that really has changed a lot is how the CFO is part, is big part of the collaboration, especially with the sales team, early stage. That's super important that we're partners with each other, the salespeople and the CFO, because we need to know, to manage cash, we need to know new sales as well.
Right. So tying into CPQ, being able to get the contract and make sure you feel good about it. And so that's one of the things we do at Maxio, is that two-way integration. It's one of the things that we've talked about is, do we want to invest more in the CPQ system to own that full order to cash? We found, though, most companies today, the CPQ, the decision to buy CPQ still rolls up into a CRO versus the head of finance.
Yeah.
And so for us, it turns into, well, do we want to build another go-to-market motion where we're trying to target revenue folks to buy CPQ versus, but I do think over time there may be, and maybe if you, how do you think about CFOs and owning the CPQ and bringing it into the,
this is a little fascination. This is my fascination, is RevOps. Who owns RevOps? And that's like the most, one of the most critical parts of these organizations, and how that has to work well. And it has to work well from my perspective as the CFO, so I know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
At least I have a good idea, right? Like, I can't go into a quarter and then, you know, you would close half of what we expected. You look like a bunch of morons in front of your investors, you know, right? And nobody's happy. Right, in those situations. So there's that kind of like understanding what's going on, who's policing that, who's kind of bringing all those pieces together, the sales team, the finance team, and getting everybody what they need. That's a fascinating role.
When I was growing up, we would have sales ops, like when I was at Salesforce, they basically invented that idea, sales operations and being in Salesforce. And then I'd been in marketing for a long time. We had marketing operations and so much complexity in the marketing tech stack. And then you had success operations, the people supporting the customer success on Gainsight, Churn Zero, or one of those. One of the
Churn Zero is a client of ours.
Is it? Oh, yeah. You might. I just saw him in New York. Great guy. Great product. I think there's enormous value connecting company data with customer data to what we were talking about before, is being able to show when a customer is coming up for renewal and then have all the data in front of you from a system like Churn Zero or Gainsight, where you're looking to see, well, what's that customer's health? What's been going on with their tickets? Do we think they're going to attrit? Do you get in front of them before the renewal rather than just having
finance teams in front of them and the invoice? And staying on top of them and helping them use the app platform all the way through. Driving success. Yeah. No, it's a great product.
They're great guy, great product. I worked for Maria Martinez at Salesforce, who brought life into this idea of customer success back, this is years ago, and how do you make that something more than just support answering tickets, and instead adding value and investing in customer success. And so the Nick Mehta at Gainsight really took that and ran, wrote the book, and has great success there as well. But I do think that whole idea of RevOps, bridging those three. So signing up the customer, going out and marketing. So understanding the marketing funnel down to the sales funnel, right? Have that whole pipeline to then bringing the contract across, implementation, value realization, and renewal. And having all that data connect across all the different systems is really hard. And so where are you seeing people put RevOps, the functional leader? Does it go up to finance? Does it go up to sales? Does it go up to a CRO? Does it go to the CEO or all of the above?
Usually sales.
But
I think sometimes I feel like sales doesn't appreciate that role as it should be, right? Because it's kind of, you know, it's almost like back office. And it's so important to understand like all these metrics we talk about, like your customer acquisition costs, your payback on that, you know, like are you being efficient in acquiring customers? You need all the data to do that. And that's where RevOps comes in. Make sure, you know, we get a good forecast. We understand what the forecast is. you know, all those things. How are we doing across, you know, like if B2B SaaS, which of our sales guys are contributing, who are not,
yeah.
you know, simple
yeah,
stuff
think,
like that. You know?
I think that's the one where I think sales ops versus rev ops is being able to, because salespeople are so expensive, especially if you're doing a sales-led motion and in the enterprise space and you have year-long contracts, big deals, is being able to understand what's working on a almost per unit, per AE basis in terms of the activities they're doing, the management of the opportunities, how many are they supporting, what their win rate is, how's that compare. Sales is one of those functions that you can just measure and compare more than any other. And
it's beautiful. Yeah.
It is in some ways. It is. It's you know, people think, well, it's just a machine. You just put a coin in. And it's not that. I mean, I think there's more to it, but you can certainly use a lot of data to help and help you better understand what's working, what's not in your sales motion.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Awesome.
Thanks.
Well, Alex, we're sort of at the end of our conversation. Thank you so much for your time. We'd like to close with our speed round, of which there are two questions. One is your favorite metric and why. And the other one is your favorite influencer. So someone that you read periodically, you subscribe to their emails, but you think he or she is really moving the thinking forward. So what's your favorite metric?
I still love gross margin payback.
Gross okay. margin payback.
Yeah.
As like CAC PMP. Payback?
But without any sort of assumptions about where a lot of people play with the churn assumptions. So like,
right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. So just straight up, how long does it take you to get a customer, you know, your customer acquisition cost? It costs you a dollar to acquire that customer. How long does it take you to get that customer back? It's a very, very simple, hard to manipulate number.
Yeah.
Good number. Yeah.
And do you have a rule of thumb for your early stage companies?
Yeah. Anything under 12, marvelous. 12 to 24 is good. And then anything above 24 can be a little bit of a problem.
And is that different based on ACV or deal cycle?
On ACV? No, it should be independent of ACV. And I'm not sure about deal cycle. What do you mean by deal cycle?
Well, I just wonder if you're selling bigger deals and fewer, and right. it takes longer, you know, it's a 12-month deal cycle versus a 6-month deal cycle. It seems like there might be some... more, you're putting more CAC into it. When do you get the payback? It may be like a 24 month versus a 6 to 12 month. If it's a $5,000 product that you're selling in 30 days versus a $50,000 product you're selling over 4 months.
Yeah, well, then, you know, if the ACV is the same and it takes you that much more to get it, it's a worse business, right? So
yeah.
unfortunately, we see this in our enterprise customer, like our big ticket, like 250.
Yeah.
A year, you know, you got to get a lot of ACV back.
Yeah.
You're gonna have a salesperson going out to different customers and stuff like that.
Got it. So you think it's a great equalizer. It aligns
yeah.
with how much are you, almost like your customer acquisition cost. How much are you spending to acquire and getting a return? Awesome. And then who do you think's out there writing good stuff or someone that you like to follow?
On the SaaS side, I do like his emails. Ben Murray of SaaS CFO, he just does good stuff. I love this one he sent out recently about what are the metrics for bootstrap companies?
Right.
Know? Yeah.
Yeah.
It was just kind of neat, different perspective because we do work with bootstrap companies
yeah.
and it's different. They didn't get the capital, you know, so they're not going to do the same things as these venture-backed companies
yeah.
Because just it's a different path, but it's still legitimate. It's a great way to build a business. So it was just a neat perspective. It was kind of neat. And he does do a lot of that stuff. So
he does. And he does a great job promoting community. We just had him actually with Ray Reich in Denver as part of bring people together, bring folks together for a dinner and conversation. And Ben came in and it's just a great guy, just super low key and very helpful. I, in fact, took his course right before I started at Maxio. I had been in SaaS, but it had been a while since I've gone back and really looked at the metrics. And I thought, well, gosh, I'm going to a company that one of the legacy companies was SaaS operating metrics. I better get my knowledge tuned up because there are so many different definitions and ways of doing it. And the other thing he does in his course, which is great, he provides a lot of benchmarks. So he's done all the work to read all the benchmarks and then provide that, again, by ACV or stage. If you're looking at this type of company in this context, this go-to-market, this is what a good benchmark is. And so it was great. It was a great refresher. I recommend it to everybody. And he's a great guy. So that's a great one. Well, thank you, Alex. Right. Thank you for your time. Really appreciate you being here and sharing some of your thoughts.
This was great. Thank you, Randy.